So welcome to the N1C Fireside Chat. We are happy to have you guys all here today. I'm very excited about this conversation. To kick us off, we're going to go ahead and do introductions of everybody that we have on this call. So I'm Steph Leonard. I'm the project manager for N1C. Roxanne, I'm going to turn over to you.
Hi, I'm Roxanne Redis. I'm an associate science director for Discovery, and I'm working for Charles River Laboratories.
Thanks.
And hello, this is Bryn Martin. I'm serving as Vice President of Research at Alcyon Therapeutics and Adjunct Associate Professor of Chemical and Biological Engineering at University of Idaho. And it's great to be here.
Hi, I'm Joe Madsen. I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon, professor of neurosurgery, and very happy to be collaborating with the group.
Hi, I'm Charles Birdie. I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist, pain physician, professor of at Boston Children's Hospital, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School, involved in various approaches to spinal delivery of ASOs in both clinical trials and clinical practice. Very happy to be here as well.
And I'm Vilika Farah-Mum. I'm a professor at the Leiden University Medical Center. I'm a preclinical researcher developing splice modulating ASO treatments for brain disorders. I'm part of the N1C, the co-lead of the N1C preclinical work group and director of the Dutch Center of RNA Therapeutics and part of the board of the European 1N1M network.
Hi, this is Kat Meyer. I'm the Chief Scientific Officer of Alcyon Therapeutics and courtesy assistant professor at University of Missou. I've been working on gene therapy delivery to the nervous system for the last 15 years, as in particular focus on spinal cord delivery and the CSF delivery. Very nice to be here.
Thank you guys all so much. Roxanna, let's turn it over to you and you can kind of set the stage and what we're going to talk about today.
Thank you, Steph, and thank you for everyone for being here and participating in this podcast. So the topic that I wanted to discuss today is around ASO biodistribution to the brain. And to give you a little bit of background of what triggered this topic is one of the programs that we've been working on for a neurodevelopmental disorder. It's a rare disease. We did the discovery for the antisense oligonucleotide and everything looked perfect in the discovery. We saw beautiful efficacy at the mRNA and protein level. We saw functional rescue. Unfortunately, when we went into the intrathecal biodistribution study, we noticed that the molecule is not distributing well in the brain. So we saw efficacy and we found back some of the ASO in really at the entry point in the brain. But the vast majority was just being taken out of the system and you could find it back in the liver and the kidney where it usually is. So we've been trying to figure out how can we overcome this issue. And it's always the dilemma on should we invest time into fixing this particular molecule or should we just shelf it and go to the next best molecule? So I want to kind of have your input on what is your opinion of what would be the best way forward? Are there ways in which we can improve the molecule? Are there ways in which we can actually anticipate these type of issues already in vitro so that we avoid stopping the program at some point? Charles,
hi. To me, you've raised one of the challenges of using rodents as a predictor for humans. And in many areas of drug development, that's a concern that there's the scaling issues, there's the issues of just different biology, different geometry of the CNS, if you will, which Bryn, Joe, and others can speak to. But I think the challenge for you is it a false negative case? And do you invest in another species or another model to see if it distributes better? I think the technical issues of how you deliver in a rodent or other preclinical model are really substantial in terms of where in the nervous system, CSF flow, all those kind of things. Joe, Bryn, Catherine, others. You know, Catherine knows this well.
I was also going to say, I agree. I think, you know, based on a failed IT injection cohort in rats, I would not give up on a molecule. The question is really, is it the fault of the molecule or is it the fault of the protocol of injection? And there is many things that can be improved to get better biodistribution to the brain. And I think this is really a topic that is broadly overseen in the field. People are not paying attention to it, and it leads to potentially subpar efficacy in clinical trials as well. Now, Brin's team at Osion has been working very hard on developing prediction tools that can be used to study the flow of the CSF and factor in even the composition of the drug, the volume, the positioning of the patient. All of these could make a difference. I don't know, Bryn, if you want to add a few words there.
Yeah, so I agree with the comments made by Dr. Birdie and Dr. Meyer. I'm wondering, Roxana, can you describe your thought process that you go through when a molecule doesn't do well? You mentioned earlier that you thought there could be something going on in the molecular biology with binding. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you go about thinking, you know, where a molecule goes? It doesn't just go to the liver. What's the process that it's getting there?
Well, you bring up a very good point. And actually, I'm going to start with what Schultz brought up. So the fact that there may be differences between the rodents and the non-human primates, and we have considered that. And of course, we are thinking about taking the molecule into a non-human primate IT study. The issue there is that the family is sponsoring the study, so the funds are limited. So we have to think twice or four times whether we're going to spend that money for a non-human primate, and maybe we're going to end up with the same result, or if we're going to further invest into optimizing the molecule and try again in an intrathecal delivery in the rat. And we did run two rat IT studies, so it wasn't one time that we observed that. It was twice, so it is obvious that something is happening. And to your point, Bryn, my hypothesis is that it's probably binding some protein in the CSF, and that is shuttling it out of the brain, because our colleagues in the bioanalytics, they mentioned that the ASO was very sticky when they had to develop the method, something that was unusual for them. And again, we see very good knockdown even in the liver and in the kidney. So the molecule is effective. It's just that we aren't able to penetrate into the brain, into the regions where we need to get it.
If you think about ASOs as a group, they're in a fairly narrow range of molecular size, charge, and other physical chemical characteristics compared to small molecules, proteins, et cetera. Is there a track record in other settings of ASOs being so radically different from each other in their stickiness or physical chemistry, as opposed to target engagement, you know, binding to in sequence dependent binding? Is that known in the field in general?
I'm going to give my two cents on this one, because I don't have all the knowledge, but based on my understanding, there's always a combination of the chemical modifications and of sequence that determine also the secondary structure of this molecule. And I feel that this is probably what it is causing the stickiness. There were no issues with manufacturing yet. It was easy to manufacture, and actually the last batch that we put into the rat IT study was already the GMP batch. So we were that far advanced into the study. So I honestly don't know exactly.
So let me walk you through how I would think about it is, you know, what's the simplest solution, simplest answer here, which is not always the case. But when we run our computer models, we do digital models of drug delivery in the CSF. In virtually every species that we simulate, when you do a lumbar puncture and we do typical injection kinds of volumes and rates, where it's administered in the lumbar interthecal space, we see that there's approximately 1 to 2 logs of decrement of the drug concentration along the neuroaxis. So in other words, near your delivery site, you're getting typically 100 times more than around the brain. So to me, the simplest answer is, and actually we see that in any animal model that we do and human. You know, it's not just one, it's that you have much higher concentration near your injection site and very much lower further away. And so the simplest answer to me is that you're just not getting very much around your target of interest, your brain. It doesn't mean that that's the only solution to getting it, for example, deeper and higher concentration, you know, everywhere in the brain. But for sure, the biodistribution at baseline around the surface of the brain tissue can be, you know, easily 100-fold different between the lower spinal cord and around the brain. And then what we typically do is we run, you know, 50 to 100 simulations of different kinds of scenarios, different injections, different devices, different injection position rates, volumes, you know, densities of solution to figure out which one would get a higher, you know, we typically look at AUC curve, AUC values around the brain to get a higher AUC around the brain. And then we don't assume that that would be the correct amount precisely. We just say this is a good starting point to then test your animal model. So the animal model is still crucial to prove it. But we would, you know, we'd take a lot of swings and a lot of practice before going to an animal with that kind of tool.
And was that, is that, would you recommend then to try that directly into an HP or into a rat still? We have pushed the dose. This is always well tolerated. This is why it's difficult to part ways with it, because it's efficacious, it's well tolerated. We just don't not getting enough where we need to get it.
There are a lot of approaches that sort of turn the model on its head, though, of you know, trying to inject an agent somewhere, whether it's into CSF or into blood or into some into the ventricle, wherever, that I'm curious how the N of one model biases us away from thinking about if we had a particular disease that we wanted very focal delivery in the brain, for example, that might be better done with a, you know, an injection of a biodegradable wafer, a free swimming magnetic robot. You know, there are a lot of technologies that are that might make a lot of sense for a lot of very specific conditions. But to think about those in this setting, you almost have to think about two very complicated, you know, solving two problems that sound very complicated on them, you know, individually. One is figuring out a gene that you can solve, and secondly, how to deliver it to exactly the right place. And I think the big challenge going forward in a lot of this is going to be to say, how do we learn enough about each one of these that we can generalize and say, this, you know, this gene would have worked if we could have gotten it into the brain, but we're not getting it into the brain. And instead of just giving up on it, to say, so how do we fix that? I mean, for neurosurgeons, this is all we know how to do.
That's, I think, an excellent point. We've tested, well, not us, but the different collaborators have tested the same ASO directly with ICV injections into mice in a mouse model, and we saw that it's efficacious. So obviously, when you get it into the brain by ICV injection, then it does work. So again, this is why I'm saying we are here, we're facing a dilemma on whether do we want to further invest into this molecule and what can we do, or should we just stop and pursue a different molecule?
Yeah, because there are, of course, we're talking about all the technical the technical issues of the injections, but I think there are also maybe inherent sequence-specific causes for this. And yeah, we don't know enough about which particular sequences in ASOs give these these side effects or these detrimental effects. So, yeah, I think you also should keep in mind that it might really be a sequence in your ASO that induces this and it binds to something that we're not aware of. And then, yeah, the only thing you can do is keep everything the same, only having a slight, you said you had other molecules that were not as efficacious, but yeah, if you could test that, then that at least it will give you some idea whether it's a sequence-specific effect that you're looking at.
Something that we had in mind was to maybe try to change the chemical modifications. So if indeed the hypothesis is correct that somehow through the secondary structure that it's adopting from the sequence of the chemical modification is binding something, then the idea would be to, if we change some chemical modification, then I hope to break that cycle. The problem is having a simple assay, biochemical assay, ideally, that you would then systematically change each position, the chemical modification on each position, and not having to do that in an animal model that becomes very expensive. So
yeah, but I agree about the chemistry, but also it's also really the sequence. You know, the sequence of the ASO could also give me with the. I know of one ASO that gets into the brain, but then doesn't seem to enter the cells, and we don't really know what is causing it, but it has to be a sequence-specific effect because the chemistry has been used before for this type of delivery, and then it's taken up by the cell spontaneously. So, yeah, it could very well be that it's just the sequence of your ASO.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so I agree. I think, you know, the chemistry, certainly there could be sequence-specific issues, but I would say from where I stand, and please, my colleagues, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but any drug you deliver into the CSF leaks into the periphery. And a component of how much leaks out is also related to the delivery. Let's say if the delivery protocol doesn't allow for effective spread throughout the nervous system, everything stays in one place, you might lose more and you're going to get a lot less transduction in the brain. Now, cellular uptake, of course, is an important factor, but I guess where I would start is with tweaking the injection protocol maybe a little bit more, especially looking at volumes and maybe, you know, composition of the buffer that you use to dilute your ASO and see if you can improve the spread and if that helps you with the uptake in the brain. I think that will probably be where I will be starting my search for solutions.
Is that, do you think that can be sequence specific? So specific to particular ASO, or is more general?
I think it's more general. I'm not saying that sequences could make a difference, right? But I have not yet seen a molecule that doesn't leak out of the CSF. So, you know, you need to make sure you keep it. So getting it to your target and keeping it there long enough, if it has issues getting into the cells, then you're going to lose more, most likely, into the periphery. So that could be an aspect. Yeah, I'm going to let my colleagues also weigh in here.
You mentioned, Roxana, that you found good delivery with ICV in mice.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, can you tell us what was the injection volume for the ICV?
Unfortunately, I don't have that information because it wasn't performed by our teams. So I don't know. What I can tell you, these were neonatal mice, so probably the volume was very small.
Yeah, the typical thing that I've seen in the literature is that, you know, the mouse CSF volume ranges around 35 to 40 microliters. And then in rat, it goes up by about an order of magnitude. And then in monkey, it's about 17, maybe 15 milliliters, depending on the age. In human adult, it goes to 200, 250 milliliters. In children, it's quite a bit smaller, but more distributed around the brain because the brain kind of develops faster and the spine is slower. And then also in humans with disease states, some of those diseases have microcephaly. You have enlarged cortical subarachnoid spaces. So when you look at the scaling and the way you scale the dose, in a mouse, you might think, oh, it's just a few microliters. But even if you dosed 3 microliters, that would be 10% of the entire CSF volume in a mouse. So that would be equivalent to dosing, you know, a huge amount, 25 mil. And you got to also look at your rate. So, you know, I think some of those things can be looked at. And instead of sort of making a guess at what's the best dose, it's nice to turn the crank and actually simulate and see, okay, in a physical analog or in a computational analog, are you getting something that would potentially be similar? And generally, what I've seen is that they're not similar. We've ran studies for our own lab where we do a standard LP protocol for a monkey. We then run a standard type of protocol for a human, and we see that the difference around the brain as a just general target is 100 times different in the human brain compared to the monkey, and actually lower. So it's a really surprising result that we see. And then, of course, you can tweak the parameters so you don't change your actual dose. You just deliver the dose differently to get a higher value around the brain. And then obviously you still need to look at the molecule itself, the stickiness and so forth, the targeting, the biology to get it where it needs to go.
I think those are really important points, that we make assumptions about scaling with both development and body size from a literature that's largely around systemic drugs as opposed to intrathecal or CNS drugs. We tried to take the simplest case we could think of, and that is spinal anesthesia in the infant human, which is used a lot, adult human and infant and adult rodent, for which there's small number of studies. And it's also a kind of pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic model where what you see is what you get in real time. So you can study distribution by a neurologic exam in real time over minutes to hours for where you're numb and not numb, et cetera. And it turned out that spinal local anesthetics scale as a 3/4 power allometric model pretty close to the way systemic drugs do, at least from humans to adult humans to infant rodents. And that's some work that we're revising, but hope to submit soon. Very much simpler drug class, but allowed us to ask some questions about at least lumbar and thoracic distribution and action that way. Much, as Bryn said, much more complicated in terms of flows around the brain and that sort of, but I do think modeling like that is crucial, because if the reason it succeeded in the mouse is that you, just by happenstance, it was relatively diluted more, and the solution for proof of concept in the rat is to increase your volume relatively, then you wouldn't be giving up on something hopefully promising that way. The question of how you get things to distribute, I'll just say one more point. There's a disease for which 2 pharma companies have clinical trials in progress, giving an ASO by lumbar puncture, that the 2 pharma companies use radically different, they're both the same disease. One is in a certain volume and the other is a smaller volume, but with a flush behind it of artificial CSF. One puts the patient in Trendelenburg, the other does not. So it's clear that the whole community is struggling with what are the best ways to distribute and all.
Well, and I would just add the very interesting thing that has turned up in some of the individual patients that we have treated is changes in the CSF dynamics that seems to be related to the treatment itself. So for example, if you develop a hydrocephalus condition after you've started to treat somebody with an ASO, the mechanism of that may be totally unclear, and it isn't known what the relationship between the underlying genetic abnormality of the patient, the particular drug, the formulation, there's all these things. And in this very interesting and challenging and exciting area that we're in, we have to sort of try to figure that out on the fly sometimes. And I think it really, it makes it important to keep all of these models in mind. And I think the mathematical models are extremely important here, but also realizing that the model is changing as we are doing the treatment, the therapy.
Yeah, I think that is a very good point. And it's not just the model that's changing, right? But each patient also is different. One cannot assume that, you know, in your study population of maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 patients, you say it's a rare disease with different ages and different disease stages, they might have different flow of the CSF. And this could contribute to the mixed response that you might see in your clinical trial, which is very difficult to analyze. And getting those MRIs to be able to study the patients before you inject them. In the future, you know, one could even imagine that the protocol can be adjusted for individual patients that way, because one method or volume might not be the most optimal for every single patient in your trial.
You know, I have another question. So the case we're discussing where, you know, you're lacking the biodistribution of this molecule that you're excited about. How often is this happening? Like, is this, I hear of it a lot, but I'm wondering, can we speculate? Is it right now we've got 100 drugs sitting there? Is it 1,000? You know, and, you know, if we could, let's just imagine we could figure this out. We could get much higher distribution around your target. Dr. Birdie mentioned that they're not all the same, or actually Dr. Madsen, you know, maybe some diseases are cerebellar and you don't want it everywhere. You want cerebellar or, you know, so forth. But let's imagine you could target, you know, how many drugs would be resurrected? Is it as big as we think? Or
you're spot on what was my question or my thought behind having this podcast, because I was wondering, is this something that is more broadly happening? So for sure, it's not the single drug that we're working on right now, because we've been working on other drugs and those we have successfully delivered to the brain. And I'm not questioning the ability of the team who's doing the intrathecal injections. They are world-class from that perspective. So it has to do with this particular molecule. I really like the idea of tweaking the volume and having those mathematical models to kind of simulate how can we get a better flow into the brain. I think that's definitely something that can be explored, because we haven't thought about that. We have just tried the protocols that we typically try for these molecules and that have worked previously. Another question that maybe I want to put here is, have you considered, or should we consider, going with a different route of administration? So as a reminder, for the mouse, we didn't do intrathecal, we did ICV injections. And that's because that really distributes well in the brain. There is the point of ICV or ICM or IT. So what are your thoughts on it?
So and even a bigger question, and why not just do it in the blood? Using transporters, right? That's another one. Right now. So for the first one, like the biggest one, I think, which is the transporter route in the blood, you know, it seems like there is some really exciting data out there. From the assessment we have done, sort of comprehensive literature review, it seems like you really do have more direct access to the brain through the intrathecal route. You know, the doses are always substantially smaller, whether it's for a small molecule like morphine. Typically, Dr. Birdie, I don't want to speak on your part, but between 4,000 and 8,000 times less morphine needed intrathecally to have the same effect as through the blood. Is that more or less?
It depends on single dose or over time, but somewhere around 100-fold for morphine intrathecal to systemic, if time averaged, but huge ratio.
Huge. So right
huge
there.
Huge ratio.
So when you look at lots of different molecules, you see that trend. So you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater just because you're not seeing initial and immediate, you know, perfect spread around the brain intrathecally. I don't think it necessarily means you have to pursue entirely new molecules through the blood side. Why not try to, you know, figure out what's going on the intrathecal side? So that's a bias, you know, I have. And then for the routes intrathecal, definitely there's very different biodistributions. We have a bunch of different papers published on different intrathecal routes, dosing regimens, devices. Concerning the ventricular route, what we have seen, very interestingly, we've looked at some methotrexate delivery through the interventricular cisterns. And we see that most of the protocols that are done through intrathecal methotrexate has most of the methotrexate remaining in the ventricles. It doesn't sort of spread out a lot, at least for the protocols we looked at. And, you know, we had questions in that study. If you want it to just stay in the ventricle, is it too concentrated, right? And then one other thing that we found is generally you don't really get contralateral ventricle spread. So even though the ventricle is a nice idea, if you're really going to get more uniform spread, you might have to drill two holes to get both ventricles, which doesn't seem very amenable, right? In terms of clinical translational kind of aspect, can you really scale this to anyone who needs this medication? So we're trying to hone in and figure out not only what gives you the good biodistribution, but what would patients really, you know, what can... that would they agree to, and parents and families, what would they consider as reasonable risk?
Yeah, just maybe 2-3 words to add to what Brent said. Each of these different access routes to the CSF are going to be suboptimal if they're not optimized. And I think, yes, ICV and ICM, they're closer to the brain, but that doesn't mean that you are getting an even distribution along throughout the brain itself. There can be accumulation. And one thing I like about the IT axis is that, you know, if you do have overexpression toxicity, it might not be in an as crucial area of the nervous system that is really needed to keep the patients alive compared to, you know, the sternum magna or the ICV centers. But each of these routes can be optimized.
And if I can then relate it a little bit back again to the N-of-1 and a few, I think, well, at least in Europe, I think EMA is very hesitant of having a new delivery technique for ASOs that hasn't been approved previously and then use that on this one single patient. So they really, you fall back on delivery routes that are standard and that have been used previously, and they kind of wait. In a bigger clinical trial, there is a novel delivery method that seems to be superior and that is then approved. I think then we can, it's easier for us to apply it in the N-of-1 and in a few settings. And I think it's crucial. I think we're all waiting for a delivery method that is like less of a burden to the patients, more efficient and more easily. But yeah, I think we have to really wait for a better delivery route to be proven to be effective and safe in a bigger study before probably you are allowed to use it in a single patient. Yeah, and as for the preclinical trajectory, yeah, I think I also had my favorite ASO that in the last step in tox it turned out to be not a favorable profile, and then. Yeah, we also had to go back to our next favorite one and kind of had to go through. So yeah, I know it's expensive and labor intensive, but yeah, it's better preclinically to have a few favorite candidates side by side, because you never know if one of them might fail. Or yeah, this is a very unusual, it's not a side effect, but a very unusual characteristic of your ASO that Roxanne probably never would have imagined that this would happen. And then, yeah, if it's possible, it's better to kind of have a few favorites that you take on side by side and let them walk through the preclinical program. But yeah, it has to be financially and practically possible.
And possibly, though, delivery could turn out to be a way to solve some of the toxicity problems, not just a way to overcome the lack of efficacy. So if a molecule is toxic to other parts of the brain, but it's acceptable at a particular focal target, you know, this is something that people are really working on now a lot. And I think the challenge going forward is to keep all of these options available and to remember all of the drugs that we crossed off the list at some point, because we may be looking back to them at some point soon.
I fully agree with you, Vilika, on taking more cancers forward, and we've done that, and it's, we are now looking back on the ones that we shelved and trying to take some of those forward, even though we had to assume them in the RET IT, and they didn't show as good efficacy as this one.
But I would think trying your current drug, lumbar intrathecal, either by single injections or by a Yax-type catheter setup before you give up on it, just because it worked in the mouse and because in vitro it's so good. And that's not as expensive as going the whole route with a different one.
And I would maybe add a suggestion here. Yes, it might make sense. I know NHPs are expensive, but a lot of these things can also be studied in mini pigs, which are substantially easier to access and less expensive. So that might be another thing that could be done. If it's just to prove the delivery, you don't need a lot of animals and the study can be relatively short. So I think just to consider that.
And what I would say, Dr. Birdie, is before going to, you know, another catheter, test it out numerically. You can get an answer, you know, in a few hours simulating it. And then if you find the Yakish catheter really shows a very different biodistribution, then go and start doing animal models and taking the time. Because, you know, the big thing is the time, right? We want to get things to the clinic, and you can waste tons of time on these failed attempts. So in any other industry, when you have that kind of need, you need to have tools to save time and save money. And right. I mean,
I agree. It is time, but it's money also. And in Roxanne's case, with the family raising money, time and money are both crucial.
So ideally we'd have like a pipeline where you could test those ideas before going to an animal model quickly for multiple different routes. And you would say, okay, this one looks like it gets the best distribution for what I want. Right. And then as you go across species, you do the same thing. You check it and you make sure, okay, is this really going to scale in the way we think it does? Or if our, our injection volume, I'll just pick on that one, produces a very different distribution. In one animal, it goes all the way around the brain, but in a larger species that just stays near the injection site, then the simplest answer would be it's not going to get a similar solution. I have another question about the distribution uniformity. So one thing is just getting to the brain, right, which is actually kind of a low bar. What we really want is, much higher uniformity and much higher dose and less off-target effect. So, you reduce your toxicity, right? That's the gold. That would be the gold standard. If we can get to Mars in the future, in this field, we're trying to do that, right? Those three things. Is there anything else? Like, we want higher concentration, drug-target interaction, more uniformity typically, and then less off-target. Is there any other piece that comes to mind? We'd say those are the real key items we need to solve.
And what I would add is that the way of trying to figure those things out very early on and not when you're at the animal study or even the NHP studies. That for me would be crucial or would be a game changer. Can we predict those things?
I guess one other one I would throw in there is just the clinical translational aspect. Is the technology something that people can adopt? Is it, drilling holes all over the place? What's the perceived safety of the method, right? That would be very important, because if you have something that's super great distribution, but it's very Frankenstein oriented, it might not be well adopted.
Well, I think I've heard a lot of great ideas today, and thank you so much for discussing this topic with me. I hope it helps or is going to help the people that are going to listen to the podcast as much as it helped me. And I might come to you with some question because I feel that this is a problem that we're all facing, and it's probably going to take all of us put our brains together to find a solution, as Brian was saying. So thank you very much.